Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have our phone lines open during this hour. You can call in if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or anything related thereunto, and you can call and ask and we can talk about it. And you notice I didn't say I'll answer your questions because I'm not sure I can. You might have questions I can't answer. But we can talk about it. That's one thing we can always do. So you can give me a call right now. I'm sorry, I just noticed our lines just filled up as I was saying that sentence. So if you call right now, you won't get through. You'll hear a busy signal. But after we talk to these callers, lines will be opening up one at a time. And you can reach me at this number. You'll want to have this number on hand. 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Just keep that number on hand. And when we be cleared, you can call right through. Okay, our first caller, I believe, today is Jim from Arlington, Washington. Jim, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate your insight. This is probably not your typical question. I have a question about Leviticus chapter 21. It's verses 16 through 23, specifically verse 20. Brief background. My 15-year-old daughter is a dwarf. Now, I have very carefully and tactfully avoided mentioning this verse around her, and I just kind of, I want to know if you could put a modern-day view, you know, on how, you know, should this verse come up in conversation with my daughter, how I could explain to her why dwarves...
Sure.
Were viewed as less than.
Right, that's Leviticus 21, you said?
Yeah, Leviticus chapter 21, and verse 20 is the one that specifically mentions that dwarves.
Verse 20 says, if anyone is a hunchback or a dwarf or a man who has a defect in his eye,
right,
or eczema, right, or a scab, or a eunuch, these are all references to certain kinds of people who are not given access to the tabernacle. They are ceremonially rejected, but this has nothing to do with their actual value before God. This being allowed to go into the tabernacle is not what commends a person to God. The tabernacle was an entirely symbolic institution, and everything about it was symbolic. The sacrifices that were offered, the rituals that were conducted by the priests, even the clothing the priests wore, everything was symbolic to represent spiritual things. And in the course of that, there were a lot of symbolic conditions. That is, conditions that were real conditions, but they symbolized something else. And it's like the tabernacle was a spiritual drama. And people played a certain role. The priests played a role, and the worshipers played a role. Now, there are certain kinds of people who, because of their condition, they symbolized something, a spiritual situation, which made them not able to come in. Now, like a leper. Now, we don't have very many lepers in the continental United States right now, but a leper was unclean. Well, it certainly wasn't the leper's fault. God certainly didn't dislike lepers. It's because leprosy was a condition that served as a symbol for sin, because leprosy resembles, in the physical sense, what sin does to a person in the spiritual sense. Likewise, Gentiles were unclean, and certain animals were unclean to represent Gentiles being unclean, animals that didn't chew the cud and didn't have a parted hoof. Now, that doesn't mean these animals are bad animals. It doesn't mean lepers are bad people, or people who have a defect in their eye, or people who are dwarves, or people who have, a broken foot, or a woman on her period, or any of those things that made a person ceremonially unclean. The ceremonies were all symbolic of something. Now, a person who is a dwarf, like your daughter, needn't feel that this somehow diminishes her in the sight of God. But any more than if she was born with a defect in her eyesight, or with a twisted foot. I mean, people in those conditions, a hunchback, certainly God doesn't think worse of people like that. It's just that in the course of symbolizing what the tabernacle ritual is supposed to symbolize, God is pointing out, of course, the tabernacle is access to God. It symbolizes access to God. You didn't have to really go to the tabernacle to have access to God. God didn't dwell in temples made with hands, as Stephen pointed out. But it's a symbol about how people approach God and what kind of people cannot do so. Now, dwarves certainly can approach God in reality, but in the symbolic ritual, they were not to do so because they represented persons who have, at least I believe, they represent persons who have stunted growth, but stunted spiritual growth, because a dwarf has stunted natural physical growth. They stood as a symbol and a sign for people whose spiritual growth is defective. Like a person with a defect in their eye would represent somebody who has a defect in their spiritual vision. Or a person who's a hunchback would represent somebody who's not spiritually upright. These physical conditions, I know we're in our age of political correctness, we can almost not even refer to these people as being different than other people. But let's face it, people are different than other people. Some are taller, some are shorter, some are one color, some are another color, some are athletic, some are not. I mean, there's all kinds of differences between people. But in God's sight, all people are of equal value. It's just that in the ritual of the tabernacle, there were all kinds of things that had to stand as symbols for spiritual realities, because that's what the tabernacle is about. So, you know, if she were wondering about that, I would just tell her that this has nothing to do with her value before God or God's acceptance of her as a person. It has to do with the way the drama was played, really. I mean, there's a sense in which a person in these conditions were playing a role in the drama, like a leper. He's playing the role of a sinful person, but he's not necessarily a sinful person any more than anyone else. It's just that his leprosy serves as a condition that resembles, in the physical realm, what sin is like in the spiritual realm. But that doesn't mean that the person who has that physical condition in any sense, you know, in reality corresponds to somebody with the spiritual condition. So that's something very hard for people to understand, because we don't have those rituals in genuine Christianity, but they did have them in the Old Testament because they were foreshadowing spiritual things. And so Leviticus has a lot of things in it that concern people. You know, the idea that a dwarf or a hunchback or someone with a defect in their eye can't come into the tabernacle is not really reflective on anything to do with, you know, God's valuing of that person.
Okay. Well, that's why I called you. I thank you for your insight, and I'll definitely refer back to, you know, the archives of this broadcast for help in explaining that.
Yeah, well, it's really hard to get across, especially at a time when, you know, people are almost taught to be oversensitive about conditions like that when they don't need to be. I mean, it's just in an age of political correctness, we have to be really, you know, we're almost embarrassed to make reference to those conditions when we shouldn't be. There's nothing shameful about them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jim. Thanks for your call. God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. All right. Well, that's an interesting call. I don't know if I've ever had a call on that subject before. Let's talk to Daryl from Sacramento, California. Daryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. When the Bible lists specific groups of words, are they in order of importance? For example, the fruit of the Spirit, the gifts of the Spirit, the order of apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers, and the things that are listed for where we should think of a true, honest, just, pure, and so forth.
I think most of those lists are not intended to be understood to be listed in order of their relative importance to each other. I think they're just lists. But from time to time, there is a list that talks about, relative importance. And you mentioned apostles and prophets. You're probably thinking of Ephesians 4:11. But there's also another reference to the apostles and prophets and other gifts in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And he says in verse 28, 1 Corinthians 12:28, God has appointed these in the church first apostles, second prophets, Third, teachers. After that, miracles and so forth, gifts of healings and so forth. So it now I don't know what first, second, third, and fourth means. I don't know if he means I'm just going to list them in this order. First, I'm going to mention the apostles. Second, I mention prophets. Or if he's listing them in order of their relative importance to the church. I think probably the latter, though I suppose a person could make an argument for it just being, again, not so much a list of importance, relative importance, but just a list saying, well, first I'm going to talk about this, second I'm going to talk about that. But most of the lists, like the list of the fruit of the Spirit or the works of the flesh or the many kinds of lists of sins that are in Paul's writings and so forth, I don't think they necessarily are intended to be understood as falling in a particular order of importance.
Okay, one more question for me.
Uh-huh.
Now, I looked online, and I've discovered there's about 1,050 commands in the New Testament and about 613 commands in the Old Testament. Is it possible to carry out completely the new ones in our fleshly nature?
You know, I'm not sure who counted up those commands in the New Testament, 1,050. I've heard numbers like that before. I've certainly never counted them. My guess is that if you're going to count up that many commands, you're going to be counting certain commands that are the same ones over and over again.
Right.
Because I don't think I can even imagine 1,000 different commands, and I know the New Testament pretty well. But I would think that all the commands in the New Testament might come down to a few dozen or a few score. But lots of them are repeated a lot, you know. But, I mean, there might be 100 even. But I think there's fewer actual commands in the New Testament than the 613 in the Old Testament. But it doesn't matter how many there are. They all basically come from two commandments, as Jesus mentioned. And that is that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, and all your strength. That's one command. And the other command is that you love your neighbors, you love yourself. Now, Jesus said if you do those two things, that pretty much covers all the responsibilities that the law has. And, of course, that would cover all the responsibilities that Christians have, too, I believe.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Lee from Sheridan, California. I guess that's the name of it. Yes. Hi, Lee. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Love your show.
Thank you.
I think I may have another question that you haven't answered before.
Okay.
I'm a fairly strong Christian, although I'm not really as knowledgeable as I should be, probably. But I'm running across some things that I've been reading that just don't fit in my worldview. I'm thinking particularly of people under hypnosis that have come out with past lives, previous lives, and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And I know it's not mentioned in the Bible anywhere, at least not that I've seen. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have thoughts. I can't say that I fully understand it, but I've had thoughts about it for years. And actually, it isn't the first time it's been asked. Of course, I've been doing this show for close to 20 years, so we've heard a lot of questions on a daily show like this. But my thoughts on it are as follows. There's two basic worldviews. There's the biblical worldview. We could call it the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic religions, the monotheistic worldview. That's what the Bible presents. And then there's, we could say, the view primarily associated with Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, and the like. The biblical worldview is that there's one God, and he's created all things. There are evil spirits, and they are there to delude people. And people are being tested continually as to whether they're going to believe and follow God or believe and follow the evil spirits, and that these evil spirits are quite capable of intense deception if somebody who is not informed by the Word of God. Even if somebody is informed by the Word of God, they can still be deceived because Adam and Eve were informed by the Word of God. God said, don't eat of that tree. In the day you eat of it, you'll die. That was a word from the Lord, but they were even able to be deceived. So even a person who knows the Scriptures has to make sure that they believe the Scriptures, and we're continually being tested about that. Now, I believe the Eastern religions, they hold not to a monotheistic view of a God who created everything and evil spirits that seek to lead us away from God. they believe in something called pantheism, which basically God is part of everything. Everything is part of God. They also believe everything's kind of an illusion. I mean, some of these religions do. And they just don't have the same explanation that we would have for spiritual experiences that people have. You see, they believe, Eastern religions believe in reincarnation and in karma, whereas Western theology doesn't believe in reincarnation. But when a person dies, they look forward to the judgment. And on the judgment day, they are rewarded eternally or punished. And that being so, you go through life basically one time. It's appointed unto man once to die. But after this, the judgment, it says in Hebrews chapter 9. Whereas in Eastern religions, you go through many lifetimes. Now, you mentioned that lots of people under hypnosis seem to feel that they remember previous lifetimes as if reincarnation is true. And so we have a choice to make here. These people are obviously in an altered state of consciousness, and that means, of course, that something is informing their thoughts and their feelings. It's entirely possible under the biblical worldview to believe that they are being deluded by evil spirits, that false memories are being put in their heads. They're being deceived to believe that they had previous lifetimes. It seems real to them, but the demons have no problem suggesting images and pictures and stories and lies to a person's mind, especially when they're in an altered state, like hypnosis, I would think, even when they're not. These deceptions can come to a person's mind. But I think a person's even more vulnerable when they've done something to alter their state of consciousness, like hypnosis, or like using drugs, or like practicing transcendental meditation or something like that. When the consciousness is altered, I believe people are quite subject to delusion from evil spirits. And I think that the devil would like very much for people to believe in reincarnation and to believe in karma and those things, because it takes away from what the Bible actually says about the reality. The reality is you get one chance through this life to get it right, basically, to follow Christ or consider your life wasted, and then you face the judgment. That's certainly a different situation than going through life thousands of times, which is what Hinduism teaches. You go through thousands of reincarnations. And a person who's under hypnosis and thinks he remembers a past life is basically having a conscious experience that seems to confirm reincarnation. Now, if reincarnation is true, well and good, but then the Bible's not true, and Jesus isn't true. But if Jesus is true, and what the Bible says is true, then reincarnation is false, and any impressions people are getting under hypnosis or wherever about it being true would have to be seen as a deception. If it's not directly from the devil, it's from some area of the imagination of the human being, but I have no doubt that the enemy is very happy to bring about this delusion. I think that a lot of people have been deluded to think that they used to be somebody in a previous life. So that's how I look at it. I think that's how a person with a biblical worldview would have to assess those situations, of which there are many.
Very, very interesting. I can accept that answer. That's good. I can live with that.
All right. Well,
thank you very much.
All right. It's good talking to you today. God bless you. Okay, our next caller is Brandon from Rancho Cucamonga. Hi, Brandon. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Steve. I'm not calling about my previous question. I would like to get that addressed at some point. But what I'm calling about is I'm struggling a little bit with there's a lot of people believe in the Bible preaches a flat earth. And looking at some of the passages, and also when it says that the sun stood still in Joshua or whatever it was, and the book of Enoch talks about it seems to be a flat earth, and it's quoted many times in the New Testament. So I was wondering if you could address the flat earth thing mostly, and maybe about the sun standing still and how that would fit into our current scientific understanding.
All right. Well, first of all, the earth is not flat. All right. So if someone thinks the earth is flat, then they're mistaken. Now, if the biblical writers thought the earth was flat, then they were mistaken. But I don't know that they did think it was flat. Some of them might have thought it was, but they never said that it was. Now, I realize there's scriptures that talk about the four corners of the earth and that talk about the pillars of the earth and use imagery like that. You'll find that every one of those statements comes in a poetic book, like the Psalms or the prophets' portions that are written in poetry. And poetry uses that kind of language. Frankly, we use it all the time anyway. We don't believe in a flat earth, but we still talk about the four corners of the earth. We still talk about the sun coming up and the sun going down. These are terms that we know are not scientifically precise, but we're not always interested in speaking in terms that are scientifically precise. There's no obligation to avoid figures of speech for, simply because they're not scientifically precise. Science doesn't own all the realm of communication for us. And so we actually use those expressions just like they did. They used them in the poetic books, that is, in poetry. And we use them in poetry and other ways, too. You know, if someone says, I would go to the end of the world for you. Well, there is no end of the world. It's round. But we say it, those kind of things anyway. At least people can say those things without expressing a view of what shape the earth really is. So since we can do that, it's rather unfair for us to insist that ancient people couldn't do that. They might have known the earth was round and still used these figures of speech. It's usually those kinds of figures of speech is called phenomenal language because they describe the phenomenon as it appears and as we think of it, but it not necessarily as it, we're not necessarily making a comment about, you know, the astronomical phenomena or the geological phenomena. It's not always the case that we have to speak in scientific categories. In fact, we'd be very dull people if that's all we ever did. Now, so the Bible, I don't believe you'll ever find the Bible teaching that the earth is flat. You do have some language in the poetry books, which if a person took it quite literally, they might conclude that the world is flat. But unfortunately, the people who are doing that, and there are now people on the internet who profess to believe that the Bible teaches a flat earth. Well, it doesn't. And, you know, people like that really ought to leave the Bible teaching to people who know something about the Bible, I suppose, because anyone who doesn't know that when you read the Bible, you need to consider the genre of the literature, because some of it's poetry, some of it's apocalyptic, some of it's law, some of it's historical narrative, and so forth. And if you don't pay attention to what you're reading and don't know what genre it is, you can make all kinds of mistakes, and people do. A little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. I think that, first of all, the Bible does, I'm pretty familiar with everything in the Bible, I have to say. I've read through it, you know, 40 times or so. And, you know, that being the case, I happen to know there's no place in the Bible that teaches that the earth is flat, though there may be some places where the language, the phenomenal language and the metaphors and the figures of speech and so forth may give that impression. Likewise, when it talks about the sun going backward in the days of Joshua, or sun or going backward in the days of Hezekiah, or standing still in the days of Joshua, the sun, it's, of course, we don't count it to be the case that the sun is in motion around the earth, and therefore, if it appeared to stand still in the sky, it's not so much that the sun stopped in terms of its, you know, cosmic movement, but rather that the earth stopped. That the earth stopped turning, because that's what makes the appearance of the movement of the sun across the sky. We know that. I don't know whether they knew that in ancient times or not, but they did describe the phenomenon as they saw it. And so, I mean, they may or may not have thought that the sun moves, but that's not what they were trying to get across. They're trying to get across the fact that the sun stayed in the same spot visibly overhead. Now, that would, of course, we know, if we want to talk about it scientifically, that would require the earth's movement to be arrested. Now, a lot of people say, well, if God made the earth stop, just think how disruptive that would be. I mean, the earth's moving 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. It's spinning. Imagine hitting a brick wall at 1,000 miles an hour. You just think of what would happen if the earth just suddenly came to a halt. Well, if the earth suddenly came to a halt and everything was left to the powers of nature to hold things in place, things would fall over. Trees would fall over. Houses would fall over. Mountains would move. There'd be tidal waves, tsunamis, so forth. I mean, if the earth just suddenly stopped spinning and there was nothing supernatural to prevent all this disaster from occurring, then those disasters we know from natural law would happen. But there's a couple of things I would point out. One is, if God did stop the movement of the earth for a bit of time. The same God has every power to, I mean, that's basically, he's suspending the laws of nature at that moment if he does that. And he has the ability to hold everything in place. I mean, the Bible says the hairs of your head are numbered. He's in charge of every little detail. He certainly can hold all the trees and mountains from moving around if he wants to, if he wants to stop the whole thing. But something more than that, and I'm not, you know, I'm not saying this is what happened, but I would say this, if you are going 1,000 miles an hour, you can slow down, you know, eventually. I mean, suppose you had a car that could actually drive 1,000 miles an hour. I don't think any car will drive that fast. I don't think any jet goes that fast, as far as I know. But even if you had a jet that could fly through the sky, if it came time to stop, it could slow down. It could slow down gradually and eventually come to a stop. At that speed, you wouldn't stop on a dime, but you could stop certainly within, you know, 10 or 15 minutes if you begin to reduce the speed, and you wouldn't have everything flying around, you know, in the cockpit. Something moving that fast can be slowed down within, you know, a relatively short period of time without being disruptive. So I don't know how God did it. I believe what I read. I believe that in that story that the sun apparently stood still in the middle of the sky for the whole day. If that means that God stopped the earth from spinning, which seems to be the most likely way of looking at that, then God either held everything in place so it wouldn't be disrupted by God stopping the world spinning, or else he could have slowed it down over a period of a half hour or something. It would still remain in the same spot. I realize for those listening who aren't really Bible believers that it must sound extremely naive for a modern human being to be talking this seriously about the earth actually stopping miraculously. But, of course, it seems naive only because modern people don't usually believe in God and don't usually believe that God can do whatever he wants to do. You see, if you believe that God can say, let there be dry land, and dry land will appear out of the oceans in a single day, if you believe that God can do that, then there's not too many other things God can't do that you wouldn't be able to accept. And I do believe that. I believe in God. That's why I'm a Christian. If I didn't believe in God, I wouldn't be a Christian. But as far as the language is concerned, to speak of it as the sun stopping, it, you know, if we say, well, if we take that literally, that would mean the sun was in motion, not the earth, and that the sun stopped moving, not the earth, when in fact we know the opposite would be true. Well, yes, if we're taking it literally, you're right. That would be the case. The next question is, why in the world would someone feel they had to take it literally?
Quick, Steve, my main thing was, it seems like the Bible describes the dome, the sky as a dome, and in Enoch it says the ends of the whole earth and things of that nature. So
lots of places the Bible talks about the ends of the earth. Of course, the word earth can mean land also. Eretz,
yeah,
the Hebrew word earth is
eretz. In other places he says just the earth. So I'm wondering if he means the whole earth, like the planet, and then the understanding of waters being up over the dome and the heavens opening. I'm wondering if they thought that the blue in the sky was water and that the heavens opened and released that from... If the sky's a dome, then the earth would have to be flat.
All right, I'm back. I don't know what happened. My internet got cut off. That has happened in the past, not recently, and I'm really confused when that happens because I lost connection, and I didn't get to hear the final part of his call. But I will say this: I think I know what the final part of his call was about. I heard him saying that the Book of Enoch says that it talks about the ends of the earth and so forth. Well, again, I mean, lots of places in the Bible speak of the ends. I don't care what Enoch says because Enoch's not a book of the Bible. Enoch isn't an inspired book, but the Bible books are inspired, and they do speak of the ends of the earth. But again, that's what I'm talking about. That's what we call phenomenal language. In fact, I gave an example of us saying I would go to the ends of the earth for you. I mean, to speak that way doesn't mean I'm talking about the shape of the earth. So I don't know why we'd insist that other people, when they speak that way, must be talking about the shape of the earth. But I was also saying that the word Eretz is the Hebrew word for earth. And when the Bible talks about the whole earth or the earth, the word Eretz means the land. It can mean earth or land, but it, many of these statements can mean the ends of the land or the end of the land, and so forth, the four corners of the land. The language of the Hebrew text could read that way, too. In any case, I don't believe that any of these authors are trying to talk to us about the shape of the earth. And if they are, then they apparently didn't know the shape of the earth. All right? Let's talk to Ambassador Everett next. Ambassador Everett, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, my delight, Steve. Thank you so very kindly. My question comes out of Genesis chapter 18, when the three men appeared to Abraham. Yep. And identified as the angel of the Lord, and then a couple of verses down, it talks about it being Jehovah. Can you explain, is this what is called a pre-incarnate manifestation or appearance of Christ? Because the word angel of the Lord is used in chapter 16 when it appeared to Hagar, and then Abraham, and also going back to Exodus when it appeared to Moses. So could you explain that to me?
Well, I can try. It is a bit confusing when the Bible talks about the angel of the Lord. Most Christian scholars believe that the angel of the Lord, when that's used as a designation rather than an angel of the Lord, no, it's not a generic angel, but the angel of the Lord, that this is a reference to a manifestation of God himself, and Christians usually would say of Christ himself. You know, the Christ, although he was not yet born on earth during the time of the Old Testament, he existed in heaven for all eternity. And therefore, it was possible for him to come down in the form of a human and manifest himself, to wrestle with Jacob all night, for example, to walk with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, for example, or to meet with Abraham on this occasion. The Bible says at the beginning of this chapter that Abram saw Yahweh or Jehovah, and this is, he looked up from his tent, and behold, there were three men. Now, you might think that if he saw Jehovah, and he saw three men, that this is talking about the Trinity, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. This is not the way to understand it, though. As you read through the chapter, you find that two of those men were angels. They are the same two angels who went down to Sodom in the next chapter and rescued Lot and his daughters. But God is identified with one of those three men. It's like God and two attendants, angels. And, you know, he is called the angel of the Lord. So is, as you mentioned, when Moses was at the burning bush, the Bible says that the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in the bush. And yet, when the angel of the Lord spoke, he spoke as if he is God. He says, I have heard, you know, the cries of my people, and I am come down to deliver them, and I am sending you to Pharaoh, and I, as if it's God speaking. And yet we're told it's the angel of the Lord. And so this phenomenon, which you find in the Old Testament, I suppose it could be interpreted different ways by people who are not Christians, or maybe even by some Christians, but most Christian theologians believe that the angel of the Lord, when that term is used in the Old Testament, it is a reference to God, and particularly of Christ in his pre-incarnate state, coming down in a human form to meet with Abraham or with Moses or whatever.
Okay, got it. Now, my second question, then I'll get off the air and let you answer it. Can you give me your overview on the Nicene Council in 325? What was the debate about? What was it mainly about?
Okay. Well, the Arian debate was what was being settled there at the Nicene Council. There were, in the 3rd century and the 4th century, followers of a man named Arius, and they were called the Arians. Arius's doctrine was called the Arian doctrine. Now, Arius taught something different than what most Christians teach about Christ. He taught something much more like what the Jehovah's Witnesses teach today. Christian orthodoxy, ever since Nicaea, has recognized the doctrine of the Trinity, that Christ is co-eternal with the Father, that he is, you know, of the same substance with God, and he's not a created thing. In fact, they say he's begotten, not made, before all worlds, from eternity. Now, Arius taught that Jesus did pre-exist before his birth, but that he was a created being, and that he wasn't co-eternal with God. And so this was the controversy. Was Jesus a creation of God, or was he, you know, begotten by God and one with God and of the same substance as God. Now, that was a council was convened in Nicaea and in 325 A.D., and the bishops who held one view, the Arian view, disputed it with the bishops who held another view, which was the Trinitarian view. And one of the main advocates of the Trinitarian view is a man named Athanasius, a bishop from Alexandria. And at one point, the council seemed to be going in the direction of Arianism, but it was Athanasius more than any other man, I believe, whose influence, his arguments, persuaded the council to adopt the Trinitarian explanation. And so there was a Nicene Creed that was written as a result of that council, declaring that Jesus and the Father are of one substance, though they're two persons. And so this Nicene Creed defined the official view that the church would hold on this, which is the Trinitarian view. Arianism, then, was regarded afterwards as being a heresy. However, many Christians were still Arians for a long time. For over 100 years after the Nicene Council, there were many regions, like in Germany, almost the whole nation of Germany, the churches were all pretty much Arian for a long time, even after the Nicene Council. Arianism never disappeared completely, but eventually it was never any kind of a mainstream view in the church. And it is, as I mentioned, the view that the Jehovah's Witnesses teach. So that's what the Nicene Council is about.
Okay, and one more quick question, and then I'll just hang up on this one. I thought about the other question I had. Why is it called the Authorized King James Version and the controversy concerning that? Thank you.
All right. Well, actually, I don't know why they call it the Authorized Version, because from what I've understood, it was never officially authorized by the king. But it was certainly King James was approving of the project of translating the Bible. And it became the standard use English Bible in its time. There had been others who had translated the Bible or portions of it into English. Wycliffe and Tyndale had both done that. But the King James Version pretty much replaced them as the standard English Bible. I'm not sure who it is that's thought to have authorized it, but it's called the King James Version partly because it's dedicated to King James. The translators did the translation. I don't remember all the details, but I think that King James wanted it done. And we know that if you read the epistle dedicatory at the beginning of the King James Bible, it definitely dedicates the book to the king. So it's typically called the King James Version or the Authorized Version, though I'm not really sure who authorized it, because you would think it was King James who authorized it, and maybe he did, but I'd heard elsewhere that he never officially authorized it. So I'm not up to snuff in the details of all the things surrounding the production of the King James Version, but it's called Authorized because it's the one that the church is authorized, I suppose. It's the one that was authorized to be taught or to be read in the churches in England. All right, and in English-speaking countries. Okay, we're going to talk next to Mikey from Washougal, Washington. Washougal. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, how you doing, man?
I'm fine, thank you.
I appreciate your ministry. I enjoyed meeting you when you were here at Monoma Village in October.
Uh-huh.
That was a good little meeting. I got a something that bothers me about the line between righteous anger, I guess you might say, and righteous indignation. How as Christians were to be so tolerant to the societal degradation that's all around us, and not to, let it get the best of us to, be so full of wrath about what's all around us. I mean, the examples that, the common examples we have from Jesus overturning the money changer tables, or what was it, Mark 3:5.
Yeah, where Jesus looked on them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts. Yeah,
right. I mean, obviously, anger is a bad road, and So, and I definitely have to, it's a conscious effort to stay on top of that for me. So
what is your question for me?
I don't know. I guess it's more of a conceptual question on how to have a balance between the being tolerant in our society versus standing up for, biblical principles.
All right. Well, in a sense, tolerance just means we let people do what they're doing. And we don't do anything to stop them. That's what tolerating something means. I realize that tolerance in our society has come to have a different meaning. When people say, when people of certain minority lifestyles ask us to be tolerant of them, they don't really ask us to tolerate them. They want us to approve of them. The word toleration or tolerance implies something that you're not exactly pleased with, but you're allowing it to take place anyway. You don't tolerate a massage. You enjoy a massage, but you might tolerate, a person who's got an annoying laugh. You don't like it, but you tolerate. You don't hurt them or kill them or stop them or do anything like that. You might find it annoying, but you tolerate it. You endure it. So tolerance, the real word tolerance, doesn't mean that you approve of something or that you endorse it. It means that even though you don't approve of it or endorse it, you don't do anything necessarily to physically stop someone from doing it. You don't punish people for doing it. And so in a sense, almost all Christians are very tolerant of the sins of our society because we don't go out and look for people who are getting drunk or people who are fornicating and then, beat them up or, put them in handcuffs and say, you can't do that. I'm going to lock you in this padded cell so you can't do those things. I mean, we don't do that. We're not interested in doing that to people. We tolerate their behavior, and we should, because the only way not to tolerate it is to physically force them not to do it. I'm not sure how you do that, but we pretty much have to tolerate people's free choices. Now, that doesn't mean we approve of them. It doesn't mean that we aren't grieved by them. Remember what it says about Lot in 2 Peter chapter 2. It says that that righteous man, as he was in the city of Sodom, it says, day by day he vexed his righteous soul, seeing and hearing their unlawful deeds. That is, when Lot was in Sodom, observing the misbehavior of the people in Sodom, it vexed him. It troubled him. It grieved his soul day by day. And that really, in a sense, should be the way that we feel when we look at the deterioration of our society. But that it vexes us simply means we've got to deal with that as sort of a trial. We can't stop it. It's a discomfort we feel because our conscience tells us that things are not as good as they should be, but we don't have some authorization to go in there and wipe them out or stop them. And hopefully we don't want to, interfere with their free will. As a Christian, what we want to do is to persuade them that there's a better way to be, that following God is the right thing to do. We don't want to physically force them. So tolerance is absolutely necessary. But we don't have to be tolerant of such behavior in the church because the church is the family of God. And Paul tells us we need to exercise church discipline. If somebody is behaving immorally in the church, well, then the church has got to confront that. And so you've got to stop that. And if they don't stop it, they have to be unwelcomed and put out of the church. And when Paul was talking about that in 1 Corinthians 5, for example, he said, what do I have to do with judging those who are outside the church? God judges them. He says, but we must judge those who are in the church. And so we can't be tolerant of immorality and sin that's taking place in the church among Christians because, frankly, we have an obligation. We're our brother's keeper. We have an obligation to make sure that our brother doesn't go to hell through our neglect. But I can't stop my neighbor from going to hell. If I tell him the gospel and he doesn't want to hear it, I can't say, I'm sorry, you have to leave the neighborhood. We don't practice neighbor discipline, just church discipline. So, it used to be that Christians could look around in the United States and see a society that largely agreed with our values. There was sin, there was crime, There was apathy toward God on the part of people, but we didn't see a society that was embracing primarily non-Christian values as good. And that's changed. And that's so we are a lot more now like Lot was in Sodom. Now, was a Lot angry? He might have been angry. Is that a righteous anger? Well, it depends. Our anger is righteous if we're simply sharing in God's emotion toward a thing. If God is angry at something and we're angry at it too because we're that close to the heart of God that we feel his emotions, then that's not a bad thing. But, of course, anger for us, not for God, I think, but for God, for us, anger presents a temptation. Because when we feel anger, there's a temptation to lash out or to hate or to be unkind or to be cruel or something like that. I mean, anger tempts people to do that. As Christians, we have to realize that it's okay to be angry at certain things, but we can't let our anger move us to do what's wrong. That's why it says in Ephesians chapter 4, be angry, but do not sin. Because anger can lead someone to sin. Anger can tempt somebody to sin. Well, we can be angry if it's appropriate, but we shouldn't sin. It's not sinning to be angry. Now, there are some forms of anger that are sinful. And those forms of anger, I believe, would be when it's selfish. And when it's, you know, when we're just angry because someone didn't give us our way. That's another kind of anger.
Yeah, but to translate the or how to incorporate the example there from the characterization that Jesus was expressed as anger.
Well, that was church discipline. Jesus didn't go into this a secular city hall in Greece or in Rome and start driving out the sinners. He went into the temple,
right,
his father's house, and he said, don't turn my father's house into a house of thieves.
Well, where do we cross the line between, you know, righteous indignation, so to speak, and, you know, ill-tempered, emotional, wrathful type of behavior? I mean, gosh, it seems like it can turn that fast when you're in a huge argument with you know, unholy matrimony people, that's what I call gay marriage, or whatever point of contention in today's society. I mean, things get turned up real fast, and how to keep your salt and light.
Well, Mikey, the real question you have to ask yourself is, do you love them? Are you loving them? You can argue with somebody that you love, especially if you think that they're doing something that's damaging to themselves and perhaps to others. You can certainly argue that they should be doing something different, but it should be out of love for them, not because you are simply small-minded and anyone who does what doesn't please you, you know, you get angry at them for that. You have to realize that an awful lot of people who are doing the wrong thing are doing what they think is right. And we might think, well, how could they be so foolish? Well, I don't know how they could be so foolish, but many people are foolish, and many people think that wrong behavior is right because society has turned around and said that it is. And these people are raised in a society where they're told that all their lives. And, you know, if you're informed by the Bible, you know what's right and wrong. But if people aren't informed by the Bible, they often don't. And so you have to figure that some of the people you're talking to, they're not necessarily people who are trying to be bad. They're doing something they think is right and okay. They don't know it's wrong. You know it is. So the area of difference between you and them is not that they're an evil person and you're a good person, but you're both people who are trying to do what you think is right. So the difference is in information. The difference is they need to be taught. And what did Paul say? You know, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be patient and gentle with all, instructing those who oppose themselves so that they might recover themselves and acknowledge the truth, you know. So the idea here is when we're dealing with somebody who's in a lifestyle that we know to be wrong, if they don't know it's wrong, then what do we think? They're just bad people, or that they are, like Paul said, they've been taken captive by Satan to do his will. They need to see the truth. They don't know the truth. And when people don't know the truth, they know something else, and that's what they know is not right. So you have to see people like that. They aren't taken, they're taken prisoner. That's what Paul said. This is in 2 Timothy 2:24, that God wants us to rescue them, not to condemn them. Jesus didn't come to condemn the world. He came that the world might be saved, he said. So we have to realize it's not our task to make people behave, but it is our task to do all we can to give them incentives and the truth and the information necessary to help them make the right decision and to urge them to do so. But if we don't do that in love, we're not going to get anywhere with them. I mean, they don't care. They don't care what you have to say if it doesn't seem like you care for them.
Yeah, and it's just going to give us a black eye as being, hateful Christians. And
yeah. Well, that's exactly.
Hey, I just want to say, hey, man, God bless you on your trip to Africa. And
all right. Well, thank you, Mikey.
And we'll talk to you soon, man.
Okay, I appreciate your call. We're almost out of time. Let's talk to Joe from Las Vegas. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, and I'd like to also tell you that happy trails, have a safe trip.
I've been, thank you.
You're welcome. I've been looking in Matthew 24, 21, and 22 in particular, and in preparation for my phone call, I looked up how many people they said that died in war. I mean, just the Civil War alone was 625,000. Millions in 17 million World War One, and they thought as much as 60 million in World War Two.
Okay, we're almost out of time. What's your question for me?
Well, my question is, how could that be Jesus talking about 70 A.D. if in fact,
Well, because he said it's a worse time than has ever been before or ever shall be. Well, he's not talking about the body count. He's talking about the intensity of the hell on earth that took place. If you read Josephus and what took place during the siege of Jerusalem, you'll find it was far worse for the people in there and for Israel than it has been for much of anyone any time. Although, of course, the reference that there's never been a worse time is a hyperbole. Yet, he's not talking about how many people would be killed or what the body count is. He's talking about how horrible it is for Israel. There's never been a worse time for them. I'm sorry we're out of time. I wish we could have gone into this more. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We're a listener-supported ministry. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and see how to donate if you want. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.